So we're ready to start lesson 16 in our study in Proverbs, and today's class will be different than what we've been doing. So up to this point, we've looked at in a sort of tighter exegetical way of the first nine chapters of Proverbs, and chapter 10, things change quite a bit. We have at the opening of chapter 10 another statement of the authorship of Proverbs, and then from chapter 10 all the way through chapter 29 are mostly what I'm calling the miscellanies, the Proverbs that seem unassociated from one another. So context doesn't buy you a lot for, say, two-thirds of the book of Proverbs. We'll take a look at chapters 30 and 31 individually at the end, but right now we're going to look at selected topics from the book. And the part of the problem with deciding how to approach chapters 10 through 29 is there really doesn't appear to be any organization to it that I can find. A number of folks have put together their own outlines as to how they see the book developing, but those outlines are not agreed upon of being of great value. I couldn't find any rhythm to it, so I've decided that we just don't have enough evidence to see it that way. So that means for a class like this, we take this next section in topics. And I've put together a few topics that I want to cover. I thought I'd pick a couple of big ones. So this week I titled this lesson Miscellanies Number 1, Friends and Friendship. And then the next class, which will not be next week, but it'll be the week following, I plan on discussing children and child rearing. Those are both topics that have quite a bit within the body of Proverbs that should draw our attention. And there's some controversy about a couple of verses there, and especially on child rearing, that will probably take some time. So I want to look at those topics in a little more depth. Otherwise, because the topics throughout Proverbs are not uniformly treated, so sometimes there's a lot of information, like a topic of friendship, and other times it's very small, maybe a one-off introduction and a saying. And so I'm not going to address all the topics in Proverbs, and as we get through the first few miscellanies, we might have a class where we deal with address five different topics in Proverbs, because given the weight or the volume of the material on each one. So today we'll look at friends and friendship, and I hope this will be helpful because these topical proverbs, it's a little difficult to try to describe what they say, and I'll explain a little bit of that here in just a minute, but I want to bring a little refresher. Translating Proverbs is difficult, and I hope at the opening here we can see some of the difficulties in translating Proverbs. And because there's no context for the proverb itself, you are left wondering what to make of it. How much weight do we put on this saying? What else do we do? How else do we change and order our thinking in light of this when we find circumstances of life help us to, or experience teaches us we should look at a problem this way, and we find this one proverb? And when we started the class, we discussed what the nature of a proverb, and they're different. They're observational, and at the same time, they're spirit-inspired, right? So this is not folk wisdom put together, assembled by Solomon for no good end whatsoever, other than sort of a farmer's almanac of the Bible. That's not what this is. This is spirit-inspired. But at the same time, you wouldn't want to form core doctrines of, say, church government or something based on the second part of Proverb in a contrasting presentation. So we have such and such is this, but such and such is that. Well, you wouldn't want to form a great body of doctrine off one passage. And so by definition, Proverbs are more observational rather than decretive. You know, you wouldn't want to put the lessons learned in Proverbs in the same category for instructional value that you would put the Ten Commandments, say, or the account of the Exodus. It doesn't mean it's less Spirit-inspired, but it does mean that they don't apply in the same fashion, and they require a great deal of wisdom to understand what they mean and how they should be looked at. So as we go through this, I hope you'll have some observations and say, wisdom has taught me this, and wisdom has told me that such and such might be true, or here's another way to think about it. So I do invite your participation here now that we're out of the discourse sections where we're a little more tightly bound by the text. So this will appear random, and that's okay, because that's the nature of the book. So your input is helpful here. So I decided to start with the topic of friends and friendship, and I don't intend to cover any other topic today. I'm not going to mix or bundle other things, because Solomon spent a lot of time in the opening chapters discussing what life was like on the way. How do we think about the way? What do our paths look like? And the choice of the people you associate with is quite important. We were warned several times about the bad influences that exist in our life, and it seemed a natural fit to consider friends and friendship immediately after we've looked at how we're ordering our life. So I hope it fits. I think it fits as well as any other topic might, but it should be. I hope it'll be helpful. So as we look at friends, it seems like such an easy idea, right? Let's just look at friends. Well, what kind of friends does Proverbs envision that we might have? And the words used to describe, or that are often translated as friend, encompass a neighbor, companion, that of an intimate friend, a brother, a husband, and even a fellow citizen. And so that's a pretty broad latitude, and we'll see a couple of examples on how the translators have looked at passages in different light. And one of the ways you look for help as you're trying to determine what these words mean is you look for the context, right? So the context helps you understand. Well, what if there really isn't much of a context? So in Proverbs, you might find a word being translated and scratch your head and think, why do they use that? Why is it translated this way versus that way? Well, that's part of the difficulty of translating Proverbs and why it's not an easy task. And so you rely on wisdom to help understand what it is that you should be thinking of when you encounter these verses. So our first example, you see in Proverbs 3:28, do not say to your neighbor, go and come back, and tomorrow I will give it when you have it with you. We use the word neighbor. It's Proverbs 17:17, a friend loves at all times, and a brother is born for adversity. There, the same word is translated friend. And in Genesis 11:7, come and let us go down and confuse their language, that they may not understand one another's speech. And here that same word is translated another. So when you're looking at a particular section of Proverbs and you encounter a word that can be used in various ways, it's not so clear as to how you should interpret it. And I think Proverbs in chapter 17, there's a cluster of Proverbs related to friends and brothers and those near and close relationships. And I think in Proverbs 17, there's some strength there to understand how we should look at it. But one of the difficulties here is when we look at this two-line proverb that's a synonymous one, a friend loves at all times and a brother is born for adversity. They're not there in contrasting form. It's not an antithetical proverb. It's a synonymous proverb. The distinction between friend and brother, that's where the repetition is at, right? I mean, those are the ideas being repeated. And so are they trying to strengthen it? Are they trying to differentiate it? that's part of the struggle in understanding the book of Proverbs. So let's look at a couple of verses right here. In the New King James, Proverbs 12:26 says, "The righteous should choose his friends carefully, for the way of the wicked leads them astray." And yet the Geneva Bible says, "The righteous is more excellent than his neighbor, but the way of the wicked will deceive them." Well, that's not quite the same thing, is it? And this is just from two English translations. It looks to me that part B is pretty similar between the two. Would you agree that the second line looks like there's not as much ambiguity? But would you have said that the righteous should choose his friends carefully and the righteous is more excellent than his neighbor, as being originating with the same set of words? You know, so it's a little difficult to determine what exactly is meant here. And one of the things I think we see in Proverbs 12, in this particular passage, that I think helps set the stage for unraveling the mystery a little bit, is that there's an association that will lead you astray. I mean, that's the clearest thing we learn from this, right? It's, you know, start with what is easily known and then look for and try to unravel from there. But I think what we can see is the second half of this verse tells us that the wicked, they're going to lead us astray. They're going to be the ones to deceive us. And so we can start with the second half of the proverb and know something with certainty. So obviously, though, we can't avoid all contact with the wicked. That wouldn't be helpful. And I think everybody would agree that we're going to have some interaction with them. So, in fact, avoiding the wicked would be uncharitable, wouldn't it? I mean, we have something to offer them. We have something to say to them. So we do need to be interacting with people. And so I want to make a point now that's not just so tied to the words in this verse, but maybe help guide the discussion a little bit. And that I think Proverbs gives us instruction as to the three types of friends that we're going to have. And friends is pretty narrow. I would say the three types of relationships we're going to have with other people. And the first is those with whom we have and they have a strong influence in our life. So that would be the first type of relationship, that of a strong influence. And I think the second type of relationship would be that of a weak influence. Okay? And then the third would be those relationships with which are what I would call providentially arranged. And that's all very ambiguous, and I hope it'll make sense as we move forward here. But let me give you my ideas. So those individuals who strongly are influential in our lives should share some common understanding and a basic outlook of life, should share some reasonable set of values, similar values, and most of all, they should have a real love for Jesus. These are the friends that we look to, and the neighbors and the companions we look to in our times of help, and the ones that we spend the bulk of our time with. So these are the people that we are allowing to have a strong influence in our life, and the people that we hope to exert. And in order for that to happen, you need some sort of similar foundation, and that should be in the important areas in life. But those who are weakly influential in our life are going to be the largest group of people that we know. These are folks that we might know, say, professionally or civically, or those with whom we share common interests, such as sports or music or, you know, any other type of hobby, stamp collecting or whatever. We interact with them, and we share influences with them. We influence them in some degree. They influence us. They teach us things. But we don't have a deep bonding over the profound and personal issues of our life. So they tend to be at a shallower place. And the last group I mentioned are those that are providentially arranged. I describe it that way because those are the folks that God has placed in our life that we really didn't pick. Right? I mean, if you want to fly model airplanes or be a stamp collector, you can pretty well decide you want to hang out with that group or you don't want to hang out with that group. But there are people that God places in your life that you really don't get to pick, or it's not as easy to change the circumstances. And So one example would be your neighbors, right? The people that live next to you or live in your neighborhood. Those are folks that, by and large, you might not get to pick. We've lived in our neighborhood for 20 years now, and people have come and gone, and folks that we met when we were there, we first moved, are gone now, and we've moved on, new people have moved in. Well, you really can't do much to change that. And the same is probably true for your coworkers, right? Some of those folks are hired by people outside of yourself, and you find yourself working next to this person or next to that person. And so we end up forming relationships, sometimes deliberately, but then sometimes those relationships are thrust upon us, and we learn to live with these people in a different way. So Proverbs 12:26, I think, addresses the idea of those who are strongly influential in our life. The righteous should choose his friends carefully, and the righteous is more excellent than his neighbor. I think has the idea behind it that even though your neighbor may excel you in many ideas or many areas of life, you know, perhaps professionally or in some other capacity, he's not doing things for the same reason that you're doing them. This isn't a proverb that warns us against our neighbors in the sense that you should avoid them at all costs, but it's saying the people around you, you might be doing the same thing, but if you're a believer, you're doing them for different reasons. You have a different foundation for why you want to pursue the things that you're pursuing. So there's a moral component to the difference in your lives that may not be evident at first glance. So their interests lie elsewhere, and the goals that they have in life form to a different end, or they have a different end in mind. So Proverbs 13:20 complements this, and it says, "He who walks with wise men will be wise, but the companion of fools will be destroyed." So in a sense, it's a parallel verse to help illustrate Proverbs 12:26. If you want to be a wise person, you need to associate with the wise. You need to make them close and influential in your lives. But if you're set on being a fool and you're set on folly itself, you'll be destroyed when you hang out with that crowd. So when you think of the wicked and when you think of the companion of fools, you shouldn't think of folks who lack technical savvy in areas of life. I mean, it's not that professionally you're more adept at this than they are. The idea behind this wisdom and folly, as we've learned, is certainly that of a moral dimension. And the moral constitution of our friends is of significant importance to us, right? I mean, the people that you want to form strong relationships with in terms of influence are going to have an effect upon you. And if you are forming those relationships with companions of fools, then you'll be destroyed. That's the lesson of Proverbs. So the lesson is one of thinking about not so much the immediate association, but the long-term association. So when I'm hanging out with this crowd, when I'm associating with them, what's this relationship look like over the next 10 years or 5 years or 20 years? Where am I going to be 20 years from now within this relationship? Where are they going to lead me to go, and where am I going to end up with them? And that's part of the applied wisdom that we've been seeing, is that the wise man has been thinking through the opportunities and circumstances he faces so that he can look downstream and see, this is how this picture develops, this is what's going to this is how it's going to end. So William Arnott, one of the commentators that we've looked at a few times, makes a couple of helpful comments about this idea of looking downstream, looking at the end for the friendships that you make. And he writes that, "By the warning of God's word and the lessons of our own experience, we know before they," that is the relationship with the wicked, "we know before they begin what the end of certain companionships will be. The awful end is opened up before us to make us fear the beginning." So you see, when wisdom and experience looks downstream and sees that the relationship with these people is going to be unprofitable, that insight is there to make you fearful it opens so that the beginning of the relationship is the one that you start to fear. I don't need to do this. I don't want to end up on that path. I don't want to be on that way. That's, remember, the chief metaphor of the book of Proverbs, the way and the path. When I look down the way, the relationship I'm going to have with these people, that's not what I want to see for my life. And it's that enlightenment, it's that observation about the people advising you against this relationship or what you've seen happen in other relationships with people of a similar nature. It's that experience of realizing this could end poorly or badly that should stop you in your tracks. So he also adds this picture, which is really an odd picture, but I hope it'll stick with you, with the idea that when you're walking, there's always a moral component to the people that you're associating with, and you should never let that leave your mind. So he writes, "The issue to be decided is not what herd you shall graze with a few years before your spirit return to the dust." Kind of an odd illusion, isn't it? The question's not which herd should you graze with before your spirit returns to dust, but what moral element you shall move in during the few and evil days of your life till your spirit returned to God who gave it. See, that's a slightly different way of looking at it. So we might look at, well, they're just friends, we're just hanging out. And the warning that Arnott is giving us is, don't think of it as just the herd you'll graze with, right, enjoy life with, but think of it, what sort of moral component is going to be involved in this in this group that you're associating with for the few days that you have on earth and for which you will give an answer before God. So wisdom says, that's how I want to look at these problems. I know that I am not my own. I know that I have a responsibility to live a certain way. And I'm consciously not going to associate with the companion of fools. That's the idea behind these proverbs. All right, so I promise this will be more discussion-oriented, but that's sort of the foundation, and then we're going to move a little more quickly through some of the other verses, but now would be a good time to interject something. Vicki.
I was just wondering...
Isn't it nice to say Vicki?
How much maturity, though, is required to choose friends carefully, and then maybe linking that to our parenting, that our children would trust us to help them make those decisions.
That's so very important. And that was a reminder throughout those opening nine chapters. I didn't count, but the number of times that Solomon introduces a subject by saying, "My son, incline your ear and listen to me. There's something that you need to understand." It's spot on. That's right. Any other observations? All right, so there, with Proverbs, one of the great things about Proverbs is there are lots of object lessons, right? There are lots of people that we can mock and make fun of, and then we can think about them here. So here are some people that we should avoid in making friendships. So it's one thing to describe the wicked generically, right? We should do that. But here are some folks that we should avoid. 16:28, "A perverse man sows strife, and a whisperer separates the best of friends." 17:9, "He who covers a transgression seeks love, but he who repeats a matter separates friends." And in 6:19, this was in the list of the six things the Lord hates: a false witness who speaks lies, and one who sows discord among the brethren. So why is it we want to avoid these sorts of people? Well, because the ability to keep your mouth shut concerning the details of your friend's life is pretty important. In fact, it's essential in a relationship. If your friends can't keep their mouth shut about what's happening in your life, there's no way this relationship's going to progress to a meaningful level. You're going to be hesitant about deepening that relationship. And in Proverbs 16 here, we see that it's a beautiful picture that the perverse man is sowing strife, right? That's what he's doing. He's out there casting seed. And the whisperer, so this is not a contrasting proverb, this is another synonymous proverb, and the whisperer, what's he doing? He's separating the best of friends. So you've got a perverse man, and the whisperer is a perverse man, right? That's the idea. The whisperer, the talebearer, he's out there separating the best of friends. It's a beautiful picture. And I think we'll look at one more passage here in Proverbs 26, where there's no wood, the fire goes out, and when there's no talebearer, strife ceases. As charcoal is to burning coals and wood to fire, so is a contentious man to kindle strife. The words of a talebearer are like tasty trifles, and they go down to the inmost body. So there will always be people who are out there trying to separate friends. That's an inevitable part of human nature. We're fallen. But it's... So I can't stop those people, right? I mean, you can't stop the guy who's sowing seed over here. You might be able to put a dent in it, but you're probably not going to stop it. And so how do you respond to it? So the people who are acting uncharitably, when they hear the whisperer, they think, man, these are like tasty trifles. I want to savor everything that I hear. That's the picture of chapter 26 here, that things are being kindled, right? And then people are enjoying it. It's a fire being built, but folks don't seem to mind. That's why the whisper can separate, is that people want to hear these things. People want to hear what's juicy or what's secretive or what can hurt someone else. So how do you interact with people like this? Well, first part is you don't make them your deep, strongly influential type of friends, but don't listen to their destructive voices. That's the lesson for us as we meet the people who are in our circles and who are perverse and are separating friendships. Our responsibility is to not listen to it. It's our duty that once we've heard it, to not believe it. You see, he's out there motivated from perversity, but you haven't spoken to that person. You don't have a right to believe these things. Now, this isn't on the same plane as someone who's committed a public and notorious sin that's documented and we understand. This is something that's being told to us in a personal relationship. And when someone comes and tells you something, when they're whispering something, you have a duty not to believe what they're saying. Love dictates, charity dictates, as 1 Corinthians reminds us, that we believe the best of someone. Now, that doesn't mean we understand everyone is perfect and our friends would never fall or they would never fail in some sort of capacity, right? I mean, that's not the case. But it is true that when you hear of something, you have a God-given duty to stop the whisperer in his tracks by not allowing it to be a tasty trifle, not allowing a fire to spring up and to grow. So the contrast here between this 1628 fella and what's taking place in chapter 26 is beautifully depicted here in 17:9. He who covers the transgression seeks love, but he who repeats a matter separates friends. So you get this picture that when these tasty trifles are arriving, when the whisper is coming, the wise man puts a cover on it. He puts the fire out right there. He doesn't believe these things. He's not separating anybody. He's taking care of business in a biblical fashion. So Proverbs is offering a description of who it is or the kind of depravity involved when people try to separate friends by lacking discretion. 17:9 tells us how we're to respond appropriately. So let's move to the next group that we should avoid. Proverbs 22:24-25, make no friendship with an angry man, and with a furious man do not go, lest you learn his ways and set a snare for your soul. And then in 29:22, an angry man stirs up strife, and a furious man abounds in transgression. It's interesting that the second warning given in 22 and verse 24, the B section of the verse, so make no friendship is easy to understand, and with a furious man, do not go. So that phrasing should trigger you to this metaphor that we've been using. What's he saying there? What's another way to word this metaphor? Or the word this instruction in let me rephrase it, to word this instruction in light of our chief metaphor.
Don't take the path of a furious man.
Yeah, don't walk in his path with him. Don't be on the same path as the man who is angry. So again, it's this idea of way and path. Do not follow along with him. So it's interesting that the warning here is not, the warning is, well, avoid an angry man. I mean, one way to read this is to avoid an angry man because he'll get angry with you. He'll turn the tide, right? He's angry at someone else. He's going to be angry with you one day. But that's not the warning. The warning is not to avoid unnecessary wrath in your life. The warning is against associating with people like this. So why is it that we should avoid these angry people? Well, the danger is because you're going to imitate him. You're going to start learning his ways. That's what 25 tells us, right? Lest you what? You learn his ways because you're on the path with him. And you set a snare for your soul. So this idea of the snare comes back. It's a common theme in Proverbs of the way of being trapped. As was mentioned a couple weeks ago, it generally results in a slow, painful death. It's not a pleasant way to go. And Solomon's warning several times about the snare is, look for the net, not the bait. Always look for the net. And this idea of associating with angry people has a tendency to work in our lives the same spirit that they have. And these guys, they stir up strife. That's part of their composition. The furious man abounds in transgression. So this sort of folk is a dangerous sort of folk. And George Lawson makes this observation about these folks. He says, if we make passionate men our friends and companions, we are in danger of becoming like them. Although we should be good-natured, yet their unreasonable behavior will be apt on many occasions to set our temper on fire. And from occasional bursts of passion, we may be led by degrees to contract obstinate habits of falling into a passion on every trifling occasion. For custom is produced by frequent acts, and in time becomes second nature. See, the idea behind these folks is that their outbursts, as they're striving for everything, they're passionate about everything, it's unreasonable. It's ungoverned. And one of the dangers is that we get excited and we pick up the habit of becoming excited even over the smallest, most trifling occasion. And to avoid that growing sense in our nature is the reason why we shouldn't associate with them. They abound in transgression. All right, let's look at our next one. He who blesses his friend with a loud voice, rising early in the morning, it will be counted a curse to him. That's an odd verse. I mean, by any standard, that's an odd verse. So, what's the warning here? It took me a while to figure this out. It didn't come right away. But I think I got it. But what's the warning here? Who wants to take a stab at what the warning is?
Don't be annoying.
No, that's not it. That's not it.
People are annoying.
Use your wake-up ringtone.
Use the wake-up ringtone. No, that's not it either. That's not it. Yeah. It is. It's very tightly related. What do we call people who are blessing their friends with insincerity?
Hypocrites.
What's that?
Hypocrites?
No, no. Flatterers. This verse is about the dangers of associating with flatterers. These people are disingenuous and they can't be trusted. Their words do not represent an honest assessment of you, and that's the real danger, is their words are not accurately assessing you. Their words are designed to ensnare you. They want something from you, and that's why they are blessing you. So, being praised for doing the right thing, genuine praise for your accomplishments, is nothing. There's nothing wrong with that. People should be commended when they've done something well, regardless of what that is. When you earn praise, you should receive it. But the flatterer has in mind himself and not his friend. In fact, the relationship with his friend is merely a pretext, isn't it? It's a pretext for him to get something. That's the point of flattery. I need something. So learning to not listen to a flattering ear, looking and yearning for an honest assessment of yourself, that's what the true friend gives. The true friend gives you the open rebukes and such. It's the false friends who are going to flatter you. So remember, when you're hearing that praise come your way, don't look for the bait, look for the net. All right, here's another. Whoever keeps the law is a discerning son. This is 28:7. But a companion of gluttons shames his father. In 29:3, whoever loves wisdom makes his father rejoice, but a companion of harlots wastes his wealth. As an aside, one of the things that struck me about Proverbs is the just on how many different occasions there's something in the New Testament built on something said in Proverbs. Now, this isn't the only place, but can you guys think of someone of the companion of harlots wasting his wealth, of a New Testament reference to that? What's that? The prodigal son, yeah. And I don't know if Jesus is making the prodigal son out of this, but I have been surprised at the number of times I've immediately drawn my attention to something said in the New Testament based on some illustration given in the book of Proverbs. So you wouldn't call it a direct citation, but it is striking how often it's there. So why is the companion of gluttons, why does he shame his father? I think the companion of harlots wasting his wealth is pretty easy. Harlots aren't cheap, right? I mean, even cheap harlots cost money over time, right? So that seems to be pretty tightly knit there. But what about the companion of gluttons shaming his father? Why is that true?
He's wasting his time for one
day. He's wasting his time, yeah. Anything else? I think there's some symmetry between these verses that I find helpful. Let me go through line A. Both of them are referring to a father, right? I mean, a discerning son implies he has a father, right? And so whoever loves wisdom makes his father rejoice. So the keeping the law and the loving of wisdom makes for a happy dad, one way of saying it. And then this companion of gluttons bringing shame, and a companion of harlots wasting his wealth. There's a sense in which both of them involve an unbridled sensual or physical appetite, right? Of a man who cannot, he has no self-control. And without that self-control, he brings himself to ruin. These are two instances of how self-control is demonstrated. And so we want to make sure that we avoid people who are going to bring us to gradual destruction. All right, so those are a few of the bad friends. This is the next section is on how to find good friends. And I was struck after surveying Proverbs again that I don't know that I can quantitatively state this, so this is tentative until somebody proves it different, but I believe the number one way of proving someone is a friend is to become poor. I think that's Proverbs' tried and true method. 14:20, the poor man is hated even by his own neighbor, but the rich, he has many friends. And 19, look at 4, 6, and 7. Wealth makes many friends, but the poor is separated from his friend. Many entreat the favor of the nobility, and every man is a friend to one who gives gifts. And all the brothers of the poor hate him. How much more do his friends go far from him? He doesn't even have family left. He may pursue them with words, yet they abandon him. So it appears quite easy to attract people if you have an abundance of physical wealth. Now, depending on what you possess may obviously alter the outcome of what type of people want to be your friend, but friends can be obtained at a reasonable price. It's not hard to get friends. If you have wealth, you can have friends. The trouble is, are those the friends that are in the strongly influential category of being close and being personal and best friends? But I think the answer is no, as a rule. Consider Job as another example of someone who was tremendous wealth, right? And what happened when he lost his wealth? Nobody wanted to hang around Job, right? They just abandoned him altogether. And some of his friends proved to give some rather bad advice over the course of the book of Job, but they should at least be commended for being with Job when everybody else abandoned him. So, there was virtue in that friendship, even though it resulted in a lot of unwise things being said. So, wealth can be a blessing, without question. Proverbs depicts wealth as something that can be a blessing. Although, it must be said in the same sentence that wealth is also the source of a lot of difficulty in life. A lot of difficulty in life. How many friends do the wealthy really have? I watched ESPN 30 for 30, the series of documentaries, and this was on one of athletes who have become bankrupt, professional athletes becoming bankrupt. And it was staggering, the story told again and again of just how many friends these people suddenly found themselves having and how many people were with them and the bankruptcy that came, and then nobody hung around. They couldn't get their calls returned from anyone. So it's not an Old Testament phenomenon. You don't even have to have professional athlete wealth to have your friends disappear when you've fallen on hard times or you've got some trouble. So if you want to find out who your friends are, it appears becoming poor is about the best way. Another way is to find somebody who will rebuke you. 27:6, faithful are the words of a friend, but the kisses of an enemy, they're deceitful. I mean, it's a beautiful, beautiful picture that I hope if you've learned any lesson, is that the imagery is such that you need to not read a chapter of Proverbs a day. Even though I recommend it, I'm at the same time telling you not to. You need to think a long time about these. Think of that picture, the wounds of a friend and the kisses of an enemy. I hope it doesn't leave your mind. That's the idea. 27:9, ointment and perfume delight the heart, and the sweetness of a man's friend gives delight by hearty counsel. So here Solomon is, he's very tactile, he's very sensual in the physical, in the best sense of those words, that ointment and perfume delight the heart. I mean, it's a beautiful picture. It's an aroma. The sweetness of a man's friend comes by hearty counsel. And as iron sharpens iron, so a man sharpens the countenance of his friend. True friends are going to tell you what's best for you. They're going to give an honest assessment and they're going to do what's right. They're not going to mince their words and they're not going to flatter you. They're not going to tell you what you want to hear. They'll tell you what you need to hear. And really good friends wound. Really good friends will wound. Your immediate comfort is not their primary importance. What's important to them is your soul, your holiness. Your good friends will make you better by wounding you. And the process is painful, but yet Solomon describes the friendship as sweet. That's another way of putting this picture together. You'll get wounds, but it will be a sweet friendship. So A man who has friends must himself be friendly, but there is a friend who sticks closer than a brother. Here's another category. How do we translate this? One who has unreliable friends soon comes to ruin, but there is a friend who sticks closer to a brother. Well, that the New King James and the second line B is very close to what the NIV has there for line B. A man of many companions may come to ruin, but there is a friend who sticks closer than a brother. ESV, getting the second half of that in alignment. The Geneva Bible says a man that hath friends ought to show himself friendly, for a friend is nearer than a brother. Well, that's not quite the same thing. The Message Bible, which has some really helpful things from time to time. Friends come and go, but a true friend sticks to you like family. I don't know if they're coming or going in this one. So we've got another difficulty in trying to understand how to translate this passage. I've heard people quote, there is a friend who sticks closer than a brother, many times. I'm not quite so sure what that passage means. I don't know what to make of it. I think there's agreement that it's a contrasting proverb. A should be different than B. But how are they different? A man who has friends must himself be friendly. What's that got to do with the unreliable friends coming to ruin? The contrast there, that there is a better friend that's available to us. I think there's some difficulty in trying to determine what this proverb, how it should be translated. I think it's a hard case. But I want to make a case about the end of this, line B in Proverbs 18:24, because there the idea of friends and brothers comes up many times. I didn't cite all of them. And many times brothers are spoken of as being a real benefit. Now this is brothers in a theoretical sense, right? Not the brothers who bash heads still love each other, right? I mean, that's an important part of being a brother is head bashing. And brothers should do that. But not all brothers get along well, right? They're not friends. And so it's okay for brothers to wound each other, but they also need the faithful wounding of each other. Brothers need to be friends. And yet Proverbs says that there are friends that are closer to us than brothers, and at other times there are nothing is better than having a brother close by. So brothers and friends are spoken of differently, and obviously the context makes a difference. But I think what Solomon is getting at here is that you need a very close friend, and you need somebody that's even closer than a brother. You need a friend that can be depended on, who's not a furious man, and you need a friend who is faithful, and you need a friend who's not going to separate others by whispering secrets, and you need a friend who's going to be with you and who's not addicted to physical pleasure. And I don't know what Solomon, how clearly he was seeing things ahead, but it's important that we think of Jesus as a friend. I want to leave you with just a couple of verses here where Jesus explicitly says, "You are my friends if you do what I command you. You are my friends. No longer do I call you servants." In James 2:23, the scripture was fulfilled, which said, "Abraham believed God, and it was accounted to him for righteousness, and he was called the friend of God because of the righteousness." Well, you've got that same righteousness that Abraham possessed. And in Matthew 11:19, which we find a parallel section in Luke 7, "The Son of Man came eating and drinking, and they said, 'Look, a glutton and a winebibber, a friend of tax collectors and sinners.'" A friend of sinners. So when we think about friendships, the weak ones, the strong ones, and the providentially ordained ones, I hope you'll see that you need to find good friends in life, really good friends. And you need to work hard at building friendships. And when you work hard, those friendships will come. And you need to be influential in the lives of those around you and not let the wicked sway, right? You need strength for these things. But you also need to remember that you have a friend who was a friend of sinners and who has given you a righteousness that he gave Abraham. It's gone on a long tradition of God befriending us through the righteousness of Christ. It's a beautiful picture of friendship. All right, we're running a bit late, but if there's something you want to add to that, I'm happy to take some closing thoughts.
So that passage in Proverbs where it says, you know, choose your friends wisely, and but so like that passage in Matthew, and you know, evangelicals will say, you know, you have to have relationship evangelism. You know, you need to make friends with the wicked and then, you know, witness to them, kind of gradually build up the relationship before you can really talk about the gospel to them. So how does that theory, that philosophy sort of...
Well, I think it goes back to what we said in the opening with the levels of friendship, is that we have strongly influential levels and weakly influential levels of friendship. And I would put the people we meet broadly that we're befriending in the weaker levels of influence. We're not seeking their input on the important religious and moral matters in our life, but we are befriending them in a social and genuine way. They are becoming a friend, but not in the seriously influential side. Do something over here.
Yeah, do you think, these ideas of friendship can also speak a lot to who you're looking for in a spouse, especially young men? Because you're going to befriend them first, and that's going to be your friend for the rest of your life. So it'd be important to look at these things and see what's happening. And marry them while you're poor.
Yeah, marry him when you're poor. See, wisdom's growing already. That's it. Marry when you're poor. That's a great idea. All right. Any other comments before we close? Well, let's pray.